There are very obvious and great differences between the art of the Middle Ages and the art of the Enlightenment. The art of the Middle Ages was very obviously God-centered, and its purpose was to further the worship of God and the contemplation of God. The art of the Enlightenment had as its function the exaltation of man and was man-centered to the core. In spite of this, there were some startling similarities. A common theme in medieval art, for example, was the ascension or the Trinity reigning in heaven. This theme reappears in Enlightenment art, but now transferred to man. We have pictures of the apotheosis of Venus, of various queens and monarchs, now exalted to the place of God and Christ. Or paintings, for example, of Louis XIV, in which the echoes of Jupiter, as well as of medieval depictions of God, are very clearly echoed. Man appears in art, beginning with the Enlightenment, earlier with the Renaissance, but very clearly in the Enlightenment, as the new God, proudly, confidently ruling on earth, certain of all things, feeling totally untroubled and totally the master. Now, as we come to the present, we find that modern art has drastically changed. The last paragraph of Kenneth Clark's new study, The Romantic Rebellion, Romantic versus Classic Art, has this to say, and I quote, "Painters and sculptors will continue to do work that can be called romantic, but they will not draw on those motifs that had originated in the early 19th century and changed so little in almost 100 years. To use the body as a means of expressing the anguish of the human soul is no longer a possible enterprise. We do not know how to represent the body and do not believe in the existence of the soul. As for the imagery of fear which occupied the earlier chapters of this book, it has become part of our ordinary life, accessible to millions every day on their television screens. Bad money drives out good, and our present diffusion of horror makes the gate of hell a commonplace part of our daily life." Unquote. What has happened is that as modern man, as a result of modern philosophy, has destroyed meaning in the outer world, denied God, denied the possibility of any kind of essence established in his life apart from his own will, he has broken meaning in the world and in himself. As a result, no serious artist of any stature in our world today is painting portraits and nudes as was commonplace a century ago. For the truly serious artist who is a part of the modern mood, it is impossible to portray meaning, significance in either a portrait or in a nude. Man has rendered himself meaningless, so that, as Clark says so tellingly, he finds no meaning in the body and he does not believe in the existence of the soul. As a result, he paints just meaningless marks, figurations of color. The cover of this book gives an example of modern art. Now, the title of the book is itself very meaningful, very significant. Catherine Kuh is the author, Break Up, The Core of Modern Art. She has this to say in the very first paragraph. The art of our century has been characterized by shattered surfaces, broken color, segmented compositions, dissolving forms and shredded images. Curiously insistent is this consistent emphasis on breakup. However, dissolution does not necessarily mean lack of discipline. It can also mean a new kind of discipline, for disintegration is often followed by reconstruction. The artist deliberately smashing his material only to reassemble it in new and unexpected relationships. Moreover, the process of breaking up is quite different from the process of breaking down. And during the last 100 years, every aspect of art has been broken up. Color, light, pigment, form, line, content, space, surface, and design, unquote. Of course, Catherine Kuh is right. Break up does not necessarily mean break down. But we are entitled to ask, why isn't it a breakdown as well as a breakup? The human body is no longer portrayed because it is meaningless. The mind or soul without significance, no meaning anywhere. And when you have a breakup, when you tear down something or make an excavation such as exists out here, it is to construct, and you have a plan of construction. But here is a breakup without any plan. When you begin a journey, you know your destination. But it is this destination that is now gone. 40 and 50 years ago, the artists who were the radicals, the avant-garde of their day, knew what they were trying to accomplish. They had a destination. But it is precisely that destination that is disappearing. So that while indeed art has to a great extent been a breakup, now it is a breakdown. It has no direction because it has no concept of meaning. Now my title this afternoon is From Artisan to Artist, Art in the Modern Culture. We fail to realize that the word artist is a new word. It belongs to the modern era. The Middle Ages had no artists. They had artisans. What we call the medieval artist was simply a businessman who was a skilled artisan with paints or stone or some other form. He did not regard himself as an artisan in the modern sense. He didn't wait on inspiration. He worked as a businessman. He sold his goods. He kept his accounts. He bargained, he made a bid on a job, and then he delivered the work. This idea, of course, is unknown to modern man by and large, with a single exception. One musician in the modern era has did systematically, in that he died not too long ago, refused to regard himself as an artist. But as an artisan. Does anyone have any idea who that man was? A musician. Igor Stravinsky. Igor Stravinsky regarded himself as a Christian artisan, a craftsman. He denied that he worked on inspiration. He ridiculed the idea. He said, "I keep hours like a businessman." I go to my desk and I work from 8 until 12, and then I have an hour off for lunch, and then I am back at my desk to work until quitting time. He prided himself on that. I had the opportunity of talking a few years ago with a woman who worked for him. And she said, yes, the maestro works at his desk like a businessman. He is very, very strict about that. Now, this, of course, is a very unusual concept and very much at conflict with the modern trend. A very able violinist and conductor, Henry Tenyanka, felt it necessary in the course of an interview on our classic music station in Southern California to launch into a lengthy critique of Stravinsky's idea. But Stravinsky, in his idea, if not always in his music, was definitely medieval. He self-consciously was working as a Russian Orthodox Christian producing music. The shift from the idea of an artisan to an artist represents a major shift in society and culture. In the older concept of the artisan, which was possible in a Christian culture, the basic fact of society was that inspiration then was an attribute of God and of His Word, the Bible. Man's thinking had to follow God's thinking. Man could not presume to be inspired. He was simply thinking God's thoughts after him. He could therefore be a skilled artisan, but he was not an artist, an inspired figure coming forth with all kinds of inspired works. With the rise of humanism, however, inspiration was progressively transferred to independent man. The first hints of this, of course, were very definitely present in the Renaissance. The culmination of this was in the Romantic movement, when all ties of the past were severed. Classicism, which was humanistic art, which still respected the past and respected the idea of discipline, was overthrown. The artist was to work on pure inspiration. And as the generations passed from the birth of Romantic art to the present, less and less was the artist bound by the discipline and the ideas of the past. It became necessary for him to cut ties progressively with the past to show that his inspiration was not conditioned by anything from the world outside of himself. As a result, the artist also, as he moved away from the idea of an artisan, became less and less a businessman, more and more a religious figure, a humanistic seer. We can see in the history of literature what has happened, for example, with poetry. Consider, for example, the great figure in English poetry, two great figures of the 17th century. At the very beginning, Shakespeare, and then Milton. Shakespeare, very much a man in the older tradition, while a Renaissance figure to a great degree, still an artisan. What was he doing? He was cranking out plays to meet the demands of the stage. It was a business with him. And he was all sorts of things. He was the producer, he was the playwright, he was the actor. He was the bookkeeper. He was a businessman whose business was cranking out plays for the theater. John Milton, similarly, was in no way similar to our modern idea of a poet. He was a thinker. He was a man active in politics. He played an important role in the Commonwealth era. And in his poetry, he was expressing a philosophy whereby he was trying to make understandable the events of his time in terms of a faith, to justify the ways of God to men. Now, while in a sense both of these men were, to a degree, modern figures, they are still essentially medieval in their view of their work. But progressively, in the modern world, especially with the Renaissance, the artist presented himself as the new prophet. The Romantics, in particular, began to include in their writing statements, affirmations of their inspired status, so that they were in effect echoing and reproducing in a totally different concept the claims of the writers of Scripture. For example, in Revelation 1, verse 1, St. John begins, "The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him to show unto his servants things which must shortly come to pass. And he sent and signified it by his angel unto his servant John." Supernatural inspiration. Shelley, for example, began his poem, a long poem, Mask of Anarchy, a very significant title in terms of his philosophy, as well as the Romantic movement. He began it thus: "As I lay asleep in Italy, there came a voice from over the sea, and with great power it forth led me to walk in the visions of poesy." Inspiration. Natural inspiration, a la the Marquis de Sade. This is not supernatural inspiration. It is natural, and progressively it becomes existentialist inspiration. Man, out of his own being, hears the voice of existence. And fittingly, the title is The Mask of Anarchy. Natural inspiration, therefore, in Shelley, in Keats, in Wordsworth, in the Marquis de Sade, in artist after artist, became an extremely important and basic doctrine. The artist saw himself as the voice of natural inspiration. This of necessity meant that he had to declare war on the middle class. Why? The middle class, particularly in Western Europe and the Protestant countries, to a lesser degree, but still nonetheless in the Catholic countries, represented religion and capitalism. And against this he had to wage unceasing, unrelenting war. Because this represented two ideas of law: God's supernatural law, and then an economic law operative in the marketplace. And both concepts were, to the artist, intolerable. Intolerable. And therefore, he had to wage war against the middle class, where these two spheres were concentrated. This is why, of course, today perhaps there are no two more unpopular kinds of disciplines for the modern mentality than theology and economics. They're very much despised and hated. they represent the epitome of what the modern man dislikes. This law order of the middle class had to be warred against. And the result was the birth of Bohemianism. And Bohemianism became mandatory for man. There are a number of excellent books written on Bohemianism. I recommend them to you. They are written in most cases by liberals, but in spite of that, they're very revealing. Bohemianism began very early with the birth of Romanticism. And it's very interesting how the Bohemians had to live in garrets. The garret had a particular appeal, you see. It meant you were an outsider. The Bohemian had to court all kinds of unhealthy conditions. He could not be like those prosperous, healthy, fat, middle-class people. And as a result, you hardly were respectable as an artist if you weren't flirting with, or didn't have, in those days, in the early years of the Romantic era, consumption, or what we call tuberculosis. Remember the opera La Bohème? How important a theme in that consumption is. The romantic disease was very popular. It became so popular that young middle-class girls were getting it, courting it. They had to have it. You were hardly modern if you didn't have it. One historian has touched on the fact how there are fashions even in diseases and sicknesses. And at that time, the fashionable thing to have, which indicated you were right in step with modern culture, was consumption. In more recent times, ulcers have been a hallmark of achievement. Incidentally, the Negroes now are beginning to develop, as they're moving into an integrated world, a high ulcer rate, and this is regarded as a mark of integration. Bohemianism became mandatory for the artist, which meant that it was important for him to be alienated. Now, the only way sometimes you can be alienated from your community, from your church, from your family, is to be as objectionable as you can be towards them, so that you can feel persecuted. They're going to have a limit to their toleration. I recall some years ago, a very brilliant young artist whom I knew quite well, who, as he decided to become an artist, and he had very real abilities here, he would have been quite outstanding in terms of the modern mood and all, had he not died prematurely. And so he declared he was going to be an artist. Well, this did not set well with his parents, but his mother was very loving and indulgent and very, very devoted to this handsome, brilliant, commanding young man. So, fine, son, we're going to do everything to help you. If that's your decision, it's our decision. We may not agree with you, but we're going to do everything to help you along. Now, what do you want? Well, now, this was the worst possible thing she could have said. And no matter what she and her husband tried to do for that young man, it only infuriated him to new bursts of outrage, to new denunciations of his parents. Why? He wanted to be the outsider. He wanted to be alienated. He still wanted the money, but he wanted it with battle. He wanted to be the outsider. This was necessary to Bohemianism. As a result, the more they did, the worse his behavior towards them. And of course, this is a familiar theme in all of Bohemian history, right down through the beatniks and the hippies. It was ironic in one instance, in the 60s, I don't know what's happened to the girl since. She came from a very wealthy family from this part of the country, so objectionable in her behavior that the parents finally could not tolerate her avant-garde hippie behavior, so they gave her a few $1,000s a month on the condition that she go to the other end of the country where neither they nor their friends and relatives could see her. And so she was in Los Angeles on the Sunset Strip. And she lived in the most unspeakable conditions in a dump of a house with a whole crowd of young men who were living off of her. And every month when she received that fat check, which was substantially more than I would suspect almost every one of us in this room have as a monthly income, she would launch into wild tirades against her parents. It was degrading for her to have to live off of them, and there was something corrupt and degenerate about a society that required a person to live like that. However, she never did return a check. Now, as a part of this bohemianism, order, the family, religion, everything that is established, the middle class world, has to be despised. And of course, cleanliness has to be despised. And this has become, of course, a more emphatic thing in our time. In the last century, it was not uncommon for some of the bohemian artists, when they were invited into a salon by some wealthy person who wanted to be their patron, to appear with deliberately dirty clothes to show their contempt for material things. In the hippie movement, this was carried to its logical conclusion. I have been accumulating a fair amount of literature on this from the underground press, and I ask friends there, as they run across this sort of thing, to pass it on to me. This is perhaps a little sordid, but earlier this year it reached the point in the dropout hippie community there that they became intolerable themselves and to one another. And so they, in the underground press, issued instructions for their communal living and put it in cartoon form so that they would get the point. And they had all kinds of testimonials in the next issue. And what was the essence of it? Two things: that they should use toilet paper, and second, they should take a bath once in a while. It would not mean a surrender to the world of the bourgeois if they did so. Now that seems incredible, but you see, to declare their independence of the world of the middle class, they had actually gone that far. And these are youth from middle class homes where once they showered nightly, or sometimes twice a day. This is according to their own testimonials as they write about their salvation from the middle class. Discipline was dropped progressively in the arts in favor of spontaneity. Totally mindless art is the result, natural inspiration. Back in the 30s, I believe it was Archibald MacLeish who declared, a poem should not mean, it should be. And Nicanor Parra issued a volume of anti-poems. They are meaningless poems. They are just a collection of words and of images. What's the point in them? Well, as you read those words and images, they may evoke a purely personal meaning for you. They may remind you of something that happened on the night of January the 13th, 1971. And if that it does that, then the poem is spoken to you. And this is the same point of a picture that you may look at and say, but it has no meaning. What is the artist trying to say? And his answer with it will be, I'm not trying to say anything. I'm expressing something. Now, if you are with it, it will express something to you, a purely private meaning. And every time you come to it, it will give you a new, but purely private meaning. This is natural inspiration. Form is despised. There is a contempt for craft. Natural inspiration is all, so there is no restraint. In reality, technical aspects of painting, which were developed over long centuries through the medieval and modern era to the present, these technical aspects are now, in some cases, virtually lost. Are lost because of the total contempt for the craft of the artisan by the artist. There has, of course, been a revolt against reason, which some will actually call medieval, in favor of feelings as the new source of power. The old line humanism, which prevailed until the birth of Romanticism, therefore, is in radical disfavor. The old line humanism was still influenced by the old world of Christian thought, by reason, by the idea of order. And therefore, it was a rationalistic art. And of course, indeed, it was. And it was a failure for that reason. One of the artists who represented the old humanistic tradition in the last century and is today singled out as the bad artist of the 19th century was William Bouguereau, B-O-U-G-E-R-E-A-U, 1825 to 1905. In one textbook on art, or one history of art, Bouguereau will be singled out as a particularly bad artist, not for lack of technical skill. Bouguereau was very, very competent as an artist, but because of his conception of art. Now, there is one painting by Bouguereau. I wish I could have brought some of my art books to illustrate some of the points I'm making. I felt I had to give a little attention to this painting of Bouguereau's because of its symbolic nature. All I could do was to take it out of a large volume and Xerox it, so it's rather an inadequate presentation. However, I shall pass it around so that as I speak about it, you'll have an opportunity to understand what I'm talking about. Not all of it is clear in this Xerox copy, but what it shows is this: a satyr, dark, saturnine of expression, surrounded by four nudes, four nymphs. In the background, you cannot see it in this Xerox copy, are a number of other nude nymphs. Bouguereau saw these nude nymphs as a portrayal of innocence, the new man, the new humanity of humanism, innocent, carefree, unfettered by anything, an innocent, humanistic, rationalistic man, dragging the dark forces of the satyr out into the open where he feels helpless. The light is something he cannot take. And so he is unwillingly being dragged out, but he is being dragged out and he is perishing in the light. The symbolic content of the picture, you see, is a very obvious one. The powerlessness of force, of evil, of the subterranean factors of the world against reason and innocence. But Bouguereau's humanism was out of date. It represented the old line humanism. And post-Darwinian humanism in particular, but humanism after Hegel and Sade, no longer looked to the mind in the old-fashioned sense. Increasingly, the subterranean forces were the basic ones in man. Pure existence. This is the mind of man. This is the reason of man. Reason has become unreason, irrationality. And so now, humanism idolizes the forces of unreason. So that if we were to have a realistic painter in the tradition of Bouguereau, what they would show instead would be the triumph of the satyr over the nymphs. Because this is precisely the modern theme. The victory of unreason, of pure blind force, sheer existence, over the older concept of rationality. Let's approach this from a slightly different angle to have a picture of what has happened in art. In Freud's thinking, there are three aspects of man: the id, the ego, and the superego. Now, in a sense, we can say this doctrine of man that Freud has very real connections with historic Christian views of the psychology of man. That the id represents the will, the ego, the mind, and the superego, the conscience. And this is the way Freud, to a great extent, saw it. However, Freud also said the id is the pleasure principle. The ego is the reality principle. Whereas the superego is the community in its influence on man. So the superego represents the training that the individual has received from the church, from the school, from the family, from the community, which for him means that the conscience is a purely human product. The superego is the most superficial part. This, he says, can easily be wiped out. Now, art once was concerned with the world of the superego and the ego, the mind and the conscience. It was concerned with depicting ideas that the community, the church, the family regarded as important. It belonged largely in the area of the superego and, to a degree, the ego. But the pleasure principle now is the only thing that counts. Now, in Freud, the pleasure principle is made up, the id, of three factors. It is the will to commit incest with mothers and sisters, to kill the father, parricide, and to eat the father, cannibalism. This is the pure will to live. Whereas the reality principle, which says, no, you cannot do these things, is the will to death. In modern art, these Freudian principles are very important. So art looks now to the id for its inspiration, not to the superego. It recognizes that it is no longer geared to the reality principle. It is at war with the reality principle. It is a part of the will to death, and hence its exaltation of destruction, of breakup, of suicide. The emphasis on pure feeling, on will, has led also to primitivism. And so in modern art, there is the emphatic emphasis on things that are primitive. The glorification of African art, of American Indian art, of anything and everything that is primitive. And then going back of that to represent the raw primitivism of the id. To give you an example of this, one of the really great romantics, a superb painter of a century ago, was Eugene Delacroix. Eugene Delacroix of France. A man who represented the old aristocracy to a degree, was of a very fine family, almost certainly the illegitimate son of Talleyrand, representing the best of the culture of the day. And yet, in his journal for May 1, 1850, he records, and I quote, "It is evident that nature cares very little whether man has a mind or not. The real man is the savage. He is in accord with nature as she is. As soon as man sharpens his intelligence, increases his ideas and the way of expressing them, and acquires needs, nature runs counter to him in everything. He has to do violence to her continually." Unquote. Well now, this was the fate of Delacroix, a civilized man representing the highest in culture, education, civilization. The real man is the savage. Everything in the way of training, of discipline, runs counter to nature. And nature cares very little, he says, whether a man has a mind or not. And so mindlessness, violence, anti-reason in all its aspects, had to be glorified in art. There was thus a new goal for the artist: to become a savage, a primitive. At the beginning of this century, Guillaume Apollinaire declared, and I quote, "Artists are above all men who want to become inhuman." Now that was his credo. And this is the credo of modern art. Now let me quote another such statement from Homer, St. Gaudens. This is why I prefer the old Liberty double eagle, both aesthetically and for ideological reasons, because the $20 gold piece that St. Gaudens designed is distasteful to me both aesthetically and because of St. Gaudens. St. Gaudens declared, "What garlic is to salad, insanity is to art." Reason, sanity, had to be abandoned. As a result, art has been ready to play the game of revolution right along. But, and I don't have time to go in this, the artists have been less revolutionary than escapists. They want to retreat totally from the world. to destroy it, not to create a new world socialist order. So that while they have often been ready to play the game for reasons of personal promotion, of being ostensibly Marxist or anarchist, they have not been at heart revolutionary. They have been escapist anarchists. This is why revolutionary regimes, having a sharper awareness of what modern art is saying than most people do, have been anti-modern art. They're afraid of its totally destructive character. So that while Picasso and others have played the neo-Marxist game, the Marxists in the Soviet Union have wanted no part of that kind of art in their country. They know what it leads to. Natural inspiration seeks a perpetually new word, and therefore it continually changes. In the past few years, one year we had pop art, the next year pop art was passé, and we had op art. And every year there has to be a new word. War against the old. Whether it's the old art form, parents, professors, religion, the past, everything. Because not even that which they create yesterday can be a law for them today. What was a purely existentialist meaning for them yesterday is void today. They must, in principle, deny it. Now, to give you an example of this existentialist mood, the rejection of all order, I'd like to show you something that comes from not too far from here, from Triton College in nearby Illinois. Kaleidoscope Comics, special student issue, put out with the approval of the administration, sent to me by a disgusted faculty member who is on my mailing list, a very, very brilliant man. The point of this is to promote a new type of program in the school of totally undisciplined, unprogrammed community studies, whatever that may mean. Now, the cover is very interesting because it shows four faculty members with academic garbs torturing a student who is chained to a book, and the book is Webster's. Even the dictionary, you see, must be regarded as an enemy because it imposes a discipline of grammar, a discipline of meaning of words. And if you are at war with meaning, then you are at war with Webster's also, and it must be regarded as a torture chamber. A new inquisition for a faculty to require this sort of thing. Now, when you see this kind of thinking on the student level, you begin to realize what has happened in our world. Our time is drawing near to conclusion, so I'm trying to be very brief as I survey the field. I'd like to cite a remark in a letter to Evert Duyckinck in February of 1849 by Herman Melville, who wrote Moby Dick. He said, and I quote, "If another Messiah ever comes, it will be in Shakespeare's person," unquote. The new Messiah will be the artist, the writer, who gives the new natural inspiration, who frees man into total existentialism. And Melville's purpose was, according to Baird in his study, and I quote, "to make new symbols to replace the lost symbols of Christianity," unquote. And so Melville in his writings is trying to give us new symbols to replace the cross. Symbols that are existentialist. symbols that are essentially subterranean. So you have the rise, as you do, in our generation of occultism, witchcraft and magic, because the subterranean symbols are drawn out of man's imagination. It's the only real world for him. And thus, one of the very superior poets in this modern tradition of the artist as the new source of inspiration declared in one of the most important poems of this century, William Butler Yeats, his poem, The Second Coming. And in this poem, he speaks of the beast out of Revelation, slouching towards a new Bethlehem, waiting to be born. This was his vision of the future. He liked it. What he saw was thus the second coming, not as the second coming of Christ, but the second coming in total triumph of the beast, total unreason, total primitivism, total destruction. This is the conclusion of natural inspiration. The rough beast waiting to be born. As a last footnote, let me add, a very good friend who is a Catholic thinker, John Wisner, started to issue a little publication in Washington, D.C., dealing with the issues of our day. And he took his title from Yeats' poem and titled the publication Rough Beast, in order to document what was happening. But he had to change his title. People did not understand what was happening, and the title repelled them. The rough beast is waiting to be born, and men refuse to see that it is there all around us in our modern culture and its devotees. Are there any questions? Yes.
I wonder if you would briefly comment on T.S. Eliot. After his conversion, clearly his art changed.
About whom?
T.S. Eliot.
Oh, T.S. Eliot, yes.
After his conversion, his art very clearly became Christian art. Mm-hmm. But his criticism still seems to me to move in a very technical 20th century sense.
Yes.
And doesn't seem to move in terms of a Christian worldview. Could you comment briefly on that?
Yes, that's a very good question. I'm not sure I have the full answer to that, or any answer, perhaps. Eliot very definitely saw the direction the modern world was taking. And he gave a very vivid account of it in his early poems, Wasteland, Nothing But Ruin, and in his poem, An Albert J. Rubrock, what is it? How does it conclude? This is the way the world ends.
The
not with a bang, but a whimper.
The Hollow.
What?
Was it the Hollow Man?
Yes, I guess it was. And so on. In his various poems, he gave perhaps the most telling depiction in the early 20s of the direction of modern culture. Then suddenly, he broke with it all and became an Anglo-Catholic, joined the Church of England, and began to produce his ideas of towards a Christian culture, and so on. Now, in a sense, my feeling is that Eliot's position was not as clearly grounded theologically. He never was in what we would call anything like an orthodox Christian. As a result, he saw the need for the order that the faith provided. But in his thinking, he still remained, to a very great degree, a modern man. And in some of his critical essays, this is very apparent. In his translation of St. John Peirce's poetry, which he so highly evaluated, you can see that he's still tied to the world of the wasteland. It's still the world he knows best. Now, he did write some very fine Christian verse. And his choruses from the rock are really magnificent. He has a line in one of the choruses. I hate to try to repeat it because my memory is not sharp on it. But if the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church and of the future, and if the martyrs must be slain on the doors of the churches, then we must first build the steps and the doors. I don't agree with him, but I think he's sometimes very beautiful, very moving. I expect that we're going to command the future.
Also, could you briefly comment on Rouault?
On what?
On Rouault, the Catholic painter.
Rouault,
Georges Rouault.
Oh, Rouault. R-O-U-A-L-T. I'd say something very similar is true of Rouault. There was no real sense of victory or joy or freedom in him. He was like a despairing man clinging to the relics of faith rather than to the substance of it. This is true of several figures in the modern world. There is none of the sense of victory that is inescapably a part of the Christian faith. Yes.
Yesterday you brought up that as far as existentialism is concerned, they're at the end of the road. But again, today you speak about this thing of primitivism. You speak about going into the occult.
Mm-hmm.
Some other things you brought. Yesterday we made up. It didn't quite gel because, as far as human mind is concerned, we all think of things which are just beyond contemplation now, things which we never even begin to think. Just leave the human mind go its way now. They'll go back to the primitive, they'll go back to the occult level and God knows what.
Yes, but every time you've had the rise of the occult, it's been the end of an age. When the occult rose in Rome, it was only a question of time before it collapsed. When the medieval synthesis broke down, the occult again came to the fore. And you had its collapse into the Renaissance. Again, we have the rise of the occult now. It's a mark of the end in every civilization where it has appeared as today. Because it is suicidal. You see, this is perhaps by the way, but I think it's important to understand. I have dealt with this in some other writings which are now works in progress, not yet ready for the printer. But one of the key facts in the world is power. Man needs power. Now, man can get power from above, from God. But in the modern world, this is ruled out by definition. By definition, there is no possible thing above. Man is at the high point. I'll be touching on this tomorrow sometime. So that man began to look for power from man, but he didn't get very far. That began to falter. So there was only one direction to look for power, which has happened again and again in civilization. Power from below. And that becomes the destruction of man. It becomes the destruction of his culture. Because when he looks to power from below, he's looking to total unreason, to total mindlessness. Consider the devil in modern thinking. The devil in The Exorcist and a great many other things. It's not the Christian doctrine of the devil. Because the Christian doctrine of the devil is one who is the ape of God, who is trying to imitate God and create a kingdom of man, to use Augustine's terms, or a city of man as against the city of God. But the devil of The Exorcist and of all your modern occultist literature is pure mindlessness, total perversity, total destructiveness, far more fearful than the God, the devil of Christian theology.
If this model works not only with power, it works with some of the other concepts.
Yes.
You can put it with joy, you can put it with some of the other.
Right. Yes, very good. You have to find joy from below. You cannot find it in things which are good. So that by definition, and there's a very fine study of this by Denis de Rougemont, a brilliant French scholar, who has pointed out how as a result of the influence of Manichaeanism during the medieval period, this began to appear in medieval literature, so that you could not possibly enjoy sexual relations with your wife or with your husband. Sex to be enjoyable had to be from below. It had to be adultery, and then adultery was tamed. It had to be something progressively more and more perverse, because joy could only come from below. Yes.
How do you appraise the ecumenical movement in the churches?
How do I appraise the ecumenical movement in the churches? Now, the ecumenical movement is nothing new. The councils of the early church were ecumenical councils. They were designed to bring the Christians together, and they sometimes separated the Christians. But the basic premise of the ecumenical councils was truth. Unity in truth. So that each of the ecumenical councils formulated basic doctrine. The Council of Chalcedon, after which our little foundation is named, defined very sharply the doctrine of the nature of Christ, very God of very God, very man of very man, without confusion but in perfect unity, as against the idea that the state could be the divine human order. And it undercut the idea of the divine state. That's why we chose the name Chalcedon, because the Savior is not the state. Now, the modern ecumenical movement totally rejects the idea of unity in truth and says truth is in unity. Let's all get together. That will be the truth. Well, as a result, it is totally at odds with everything in Christian history and faith. It is at war with everything that ecumenicity has historically meant. Now, that idea of ecumenicity you find on all sides today, Protestant, Catholic, Orthodox. I think our time is more than enough.